Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We're going to talk this hour about keeping a roof over your head, and especially how hard that is for families of limited incomes in this region. For many, finding affordable housing in the Baltimore region is a challenge. A report last year by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition found that workers in Baltimore, Howard, and Anne Arundel counties and Baltimore City would need to earn nearly $24 an hour full-time to be able to afford the fair market rent and utilities of a two-bedroom apartment without spending more than a third of their income. A different report last year by the Opportunity Collaborative, a group of public and private sector leaders who study obstacles to sustainable development in the Baltimore metropolitan area, said that 70% of people in this area spend more than half their income on housing, 70% of low-income people. A sobering backdrop for some of the issues we want to discuss today. Why has Baltimore City's inclusionary housing program created only a few dozen affordable housing units in about a decade? What lessons can be learned from Montgomery County's approach to affordable housing? What concerns does the Baltimore County Council have about refusing to require landlords to accept housing vouchers as rent? How much low and moderate income housing should be built into the planned Port Covington project in South Baltimore? Helping us navigate these issues this hour is Patrick Mayer, one of the leaders of the Opportunity Collaborative and executive director of the Innovative Housing Institute, a national nonprofit that advises communities and developers on affordable housing policy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you could be with us. And also, listeners, we welcome your questions and comments. Do you commute because you can't live close to where you work? Where do you live now? Where would you move if you could afford it? What would that take? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. Patrick Mayer, it seems to me the public officials in this region, Baltimore City and the suburbs, focus a lot on affordable housing, and it doesn't seem to happen, or at least that's the impression I have. I mean, something like three dozen affordable housing units built in the city in the last 9 years. Why not? What makes it so hard? Why isn't it working?
Let me say it is a big focus of public officials' interest and of general citizenry interest because it's lacking for many citizens. The report that you're referring to that the Opportunity Collaborative prepared found that about 70,000 households in the region are paying more than 50%
of their income. That was the statistic. I got it wrong. It wasn't 70%. 70,000 households.
Right. Are paying more than 50% of their income on a monthly basis for housing. And that's really a huge portion of their income and creates the kind of problems that people have to struggle with. Can I buy medicine? Can I buy food? Can I afford to travel to work, given that people need to pay for public transit, things of that sort? When you're taking that much money out of your limited paycheck to afford housing, your other choices are limited, and it really constrains your access to opportunity.
So that's the problem.
It is one of the problems, and I think part of
that's the problem that expensive housing causes, and yet with all this effort to address it, it seems not to be effectively addressed.
Well, let me say all this effort to address it is multifaceted, and you touched on one aspect, which is the inclusionary law in Baltimore City, which has not been successful, as you mentioned. A few dozen units since 2007 when the law was adopted hardly merits a pat on the back in terms of the effect of that policy. Part of what has happened, and I'll say, you know, there are efforts afoot to amend the law and hopefully to improve it, is that the law as it was originally constructed really didn't take advantage of one of the city's major tools, which is the ability to approve development and to regulate land use. That's something that is typically done in inclusionary policy around the country, namely, how much can a developer build can affect what their bottom line is and their ability to incorporate and address other public goals like affordable housing.
I want to zoom in a bit. I want to understand better what's going on and not going on in the city. But for the sake of contrast, let me ask you what are other jurisdictions in Maryland doing about inclusionary housing?
Well, let me mention one in this region that has quite a successful inclusionary housing policy. Howard County has a program that they call the Moderate Income Housing Unit Program, MIHU is what they call it for short. It's been in operation now for something like 12 years. It's been a very successful program in serving a segment of the housing need. Howard County, as you know, is a very expensive place to live. People that are starting out in terms of careers, teachers, people working in law enforcement, people working in other parts of the public and private sector that are at moderate incomes can't afford to live in Howard County because of the limitations on what's in the housing market. The developers build expensive homes because the demand is there, and that's what they should do. The county has said, however, we want you to include affordable units along with those new developments, and that's been working for quite some time in Howard County and quite a success, a good model for other parts of the region.
That's Howard County.
Yes.
Anne Arundel, Frederick also have?
Frederick does. Anne Arundel does not. The city of Annapolis does.
Ah, the city of Annapolis does. And maybe I'm wrong about this. I think of the granddaddy of inclusionary housing programs as Montgomery County, Maryland.
That's correct.
And you work there. So tell us how that works and why it works.
Right. In Montgomery County, and this dates back to the mid-70s when the county was growing very rapidly, the county leaders, the county council particularly, discovered that many of the people that were needed for the growing employment in Montgomery County were not able to afford Montgomery County. And so they came up with a really novel approach, which was they offered to developers a density bonus where they'd be able to build additional units. Typically, the density bonus allowed them to build 20% more units than they would have otherwise been able to, given their density, their zoning category, if you will. They also allowed them to build higher density units. So in what was a single-family subdivision, they allowed them to include townhouses because townhouses are more affordable to build. And
so those are two different kinds of density? It sounds like the same thing to me. It sounds like they're both ways of letting a developer pack more units into a certain footprint of land.
That is correct. But townhouses, because they're closer together, you're able to build more units on a single street. Land development costs are less. Shared property lines mean that you don't have to build as many exterior walls, for example. So they're more affordable. They're able to be built at a lower cost, and that enabled the developer to meet the county's goals in terms of who would live in those homes. And they were targeting moderate-income households, and that's what has happened there.
So let me make sure I understand then. You're saying way back in the 70s, Montgomery County would allow developers to pack more units into a proposed developments in exchange for some of those units being affordable. Did the developer bear the cost of affordable units?
Yes. The bonus, the way that it worked was they had the chance to build 20% more units. At that time, they had a requirement to build 15% of the total as affordable. If you do the math with 100 units, it means instead of the original development only building or only being able to build 100 units, they're able to build 120. And then of that total, 15, and the math works out that 17 units out of 120 had to be marketed at these controlled, modest price levels. The developer got to build three more market rate units that in turn he was able to make additional profit and help incorporate those affordable units at his cost, as you say.
And I'm sure it's changed over the years, but is that what is still functioning in Montgomery County?
It is, although one thing to say about inclusionary policy is as the market changes, as different development types happen, there are adjustments to the law, and quite frequently these laws are revisited and revamped, and that's a normal process around the country.
And so what is the difference between it being successful in Montgomery County and inclusionary housing producing almost nothing in Baltimore?
What's happened to date in Baltimore is that the city, rather than using its land use authority to add density, as I described in Montgomery County, decided that instead they would pay for the difference between what the developer would sell a market rate unit, sell or rent a market rate unit for, and what the affordable requirement was. So the city adopted an approach that required a cash outlay to, if you will, subsidize that difference. So the developer didn't lose money from what he would have earned had he built an entirely market rate development. And however, the city's allocation of those monies ran out relatively quickly. They allocated $3 million initially, and that money has been spent, long spent, and it produced the meager number of units that you've noted.
I think I read in the Baltimore Sun that there's like $70,000 left in that account, which is not enough to subsidize, I imagine, even one unit. So the big difference, if I'm understanding correctly, between a program in Maryland that works very well and one that has very little impact is that in Baltimore City took on the obligation of paying the developers to do it.
That's correct.
Did they need to do that?
I don't think they did. I think that I'll say part of the issue in Baltimore City was the developers had relatively expansive zoning permissions, if you will, already. So most developers didn't fully utilize how big they could build, how tall the buildings could be, simply because the market didn't demand that. And as a result, what is the major tool in inclusionary housing, which is giving them additional density, wasn't of much effect. So that's part of the issue.
Developers didn't want more density.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay.
Or at least I'll say that's the premise that led to we'll pay for the difference, which has been Baltimore City's approach.
There's lots more to talk about here. We're going to take a quick break and then continue with Patrick Mayer, an expert on inclusionary housing. He's executive director of the Innovative Housing Institute. And you're welcome to join this conversation. Do you think Baltimore City should make stronger demands of developers? Are you a landlord? Do you think landlords should have to accept tenants who pay rent using housing vouchers or alimony? That's an issue we'll get into when we come back. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about affordable housing in the Baltimore region and the challenges faced by low and moderate income residents to find housing they can afford. I'm joined by Patrick Mayer. He's executive director of the Innovative Housing Institute, a national nonprofit, and he's an expert on affordable housing issues. You are welcome to join this conversation. Where do you live? Do you live where you want to live, or would you rather live someplace else, perhaps someplace closer to where you work? What would make that possible? We'd love to hear your story. You can email us at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. I said earlier that only a few dozen, maybe three dozen, affordable units have been created in Baltimore City. And Patrick Mayer, you tell me I'm wrong about that. Correct me, please.
You are, Sheila. You're correct in regard to the inclusionary housing program. That's the right number. I think 40 is the number that is talked about as having been created so far by the inclusionary program.
That's since 2007.
That's right. However, the city has had, I think, an effective program of working with private developers developing what are known as low-income housing tax credit properties. These are programs that are affordable housing owned by the private sector, serving people below 60% of area median income. It's actually the major form of federal housing subsidy these days. It doesn't come out of HUD. It comes out of the Department of Treasury, because the investors in this housing receive the tax credit that's in that title.
So this is not public housing, per se. It's investor-owned.
It is investor-owned. It is private. The housing has been, I think, done in some very key redevelopment areas of the city. I think it's a program that could use wider, I'll say, opportunities throughout the region, particularly for family housing, because there is a great difficulty in locating affordable family housing outside of Baltimore City, close to good jobs and good schools.
And this, so how many units in Baltimore City?
I would say several thousand, probably on the order of 2,000 to 2,500, perhaps.
Predominantly located where?
I would say north central Baltimore, the area, for example, around the North Avenue redevelopment, the areas that are close to the art district off of North Avenue. Some areas in West Baltimore have received new development of low-income housing tax credit properties, but I would say fairly well distributed around central Baltimore, not so much in the areas that are the high market areas of Baltimore City, the areas around the harbor and immediately east and west of that area.
And not in the suburbs?
No. What has been developed in the suburbs has been, I'll say, predominantly senior housing under the low-income housing tax credit program. There has been some family housing. I'll say most of the tax credit family housing has been in Howard County.
I want to ask you about some developments in Baltimore County, but let's talk to Jennifer, who has called us from Baltimore. Jennifer, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. The reason that I'm calling is that I've been very involved for the last 44 years in Baltimore City, and I've been an appraiser for 40 years and still am. Everybody would like a brand new house or a totally renovated house, which is sort of what this program is. But there is a lot of affordable housing that's available. Also, I think that the city or whatever programs would be benefited by making sure that vacant housing has a good roof. That is the reason that our housing inventory has become so deteriorated. And during the primary, I was over in District 12, which is a very has a lot of deteriorated housing. And when you talk to the people, they don't necessarily want to leave. They would just like their vacant housing filled with people that want to be there. And even on North Avenue, after the riots, you know, you and I might not want to be on North Avenue or in the Penn North area. However, right on television, when the CVS came back, one of the residents said, this is great. This is better for our neighborhood. People actually like to stay where they are. We need to be thinking about making those places better. In Election District 12, I was talking to one woman that's sort of the matriarch of her block, which is now half empty. And she said, you know, this wasn't this way 20 years ago. So, and the amount of affordable housing is terrific. It just isn't new. And I can tell you from experience that new housing gets pretty old pretty fast. So if we focus on what in the beginning of rehabs, back when I was with Baltimore Federal in a million years ago, they called it sweat equity. And maybe that isn't exactly appropriate for affordable housing because people might not have the money to make the repairs. But it's not a total rehab. It's a moderate rehab.
Jennifer, I appreciate your raising this. Let me get Patrick Mayer's reaction to it.
Jennifer, I think there's no question that reinvestment in the city's neighborhoods that are struggling is something that's critical to do. I don't think, and I think part of what people have to realize is that housing policy isn't just one thing. It needs to be multifaceted because it's a complex problem. But those neighborhoods do need help. But part of the question, and going to your point about neighborhoods being empty, the homes not having roofs on them, is people who have choices, who have the economic means to make decisions, to decide where they want to live, leave those areas because they see them as an area that might be, you know, a dangerous area to live in, an area that might have a school that's not doing well. I think people would like to see those neighborhoods transform to what they were quite some time ago, but that doesn't recognize the loss of jobs that afflict those neighborhoods, the inability of people to pay what it cost not only to pay the monthly rent, but to rehabilitate their homes, which often is a very expensive outlay. I think part of what is the reality is doing the work in those neighborhoods that is done on a comprehensive basis, where it's not just fixing up the homes, hoping that the residents will be able to maintain them, but instead doing comprehensive investments along with the revitalization of the schools, the Century 21 School Revitalization Plan, working to focus on neighborhoods where there's good transportation options so people can get to jobs. That's the way to approach those neighborhoods, and you're not going to be able to do them all at once. It's a comprehensive effort, and it's going to be expensive.
Jennifer, thank you for the call. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and I'm here in the studio with affordable housing expert Patrick Mayer. He is executive director of the Innovative Housing Institute. He's also been active in the Opportunity Collaborative, which was just referred to. You can be part of this conversation. I'd love your ideas about what is important and where investment should go in making housing affordable for people of limited income in our region. You can join the conversation with a phone call to 410-662-8780 or an email to midday@wypr.org. Early this month, the Baltimore County Council voted 6-1 against a bill that would have made it illegal for landlords to discriminate against tenants based on how they intended to pay their rent. I think there was a lot of focus on tenants who wanted to use housing vouchers. The bill, as I understand it, would have also applied to alimony and to disability checks. As I said, the vote was 6-1, which doesn't sound very welcoming. What are the factors that would lead landlords to be wary of that kind of law?
I think landlords resist the idea that another agency, if you will, plays a role in the renting of the homes that they have made investments in and, you know, see as something that they want to manage and control. The program that you're referring to, Sheila, that I think was the main focus of the law, the HOME Act, as proposed in Baltimore County.
HOME stands for the Housing Opportunities Made Equal.
That's
Act.
Right. It's the major federal public subsidy program for very low-income households, for people that really don't have the means to pay rent in the market. And it's a program that is operating throughout the region. It gives people a voucher so that they're able to approach a landlord and say, I'm getting help in paying my rent. You're welcome to look at my background in terms of my prior experience as a tenant, my credit, things of that sort. But the federal government has given me this voucher that helps me pay my rent. Landlords will know that they've got a deal, in that case, with a federal housing program. Many of them choose not to, would prefer not to. But I liken it to the food stamps program. These are very poor people. They need assistance to be able to live in our communities. And food stamps and grocery stores are required to accept food stamps. It's simply an income supplement that helps people afford to live. A stable home is as important as putting food in your mouth and your children's mouth.
There is a landlord who has phoned us from Long Green. Alan wants to comment on this. Alan, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm both a landlord, but I'm also a general contractor. And what I've seen, I think the biggest issue I have with, for instance, being forced to accept Section 8 tenants is that often Section 8 housing inspectors come up with absolutely random things that are required to be done in order to rent the property. And those random things don't necessarily have to do with safety. If I were selling a house, I could walk away from a transaction in which the buyer demanded that I make all sorts of improvements that weren't necessarily related to safety. As a landlord, I would not be able to walk away from that transaction.
Your point, Alan?
The point is that forcing those requirements on a program that says you talked a little bit about the Home Act, programs that require landlords to accept a federal program or a state program that comes bundled with a new set of inspection requirements and burdens is going to just discourage people from getting in the business of rental housing.
Alan, I appreciate your calling. What would you say to Alan?
I think Alan, you know, raises a common complaint about the program. The program requires that the housing be inspected before the government starts paying subsidies on behalf of the tenants. They have what are called housing quality standards. So they send out an inspector typically before the lease is signed and they start paying rent. I think, you know, Alan may have encountered, you know, inspectors on their off day. My review of the housing quality standards is they tend to be pretty serious things that if you don't have in place, you really, you know, wouldn't want to live there yourself. There are things like, you know, lack of covers on light switches, peeling and flaking paint, and, you know, when we've got lead paint in many of these older homes, that's a serious health consideration. The government's got to assure itself, if you will, that these are quality housing units that they're allowing people to move into and paying rent on behalf of. I would say for Alan's benefit that it's something that the Housing Choice Voucher Program administrators are very sensitive to making sure their inspectors are doing the right thing. And so some additional work to try to get those issues addressed would behoove him because it's a good program.
But in fairness to Alan and other landlords, it is more burdensome than accepting food stamps, which are essentially cash.
I would agree that it is. I think while it's a burden to landlords, a responsibility to accept, as you say, the voucher in lieu of the, you know, an ordinary market rate tenant. The flip side of it is there's some benefits that they receive as well. One of them is the programs are administered reasonably well. It's timely rent payment. If your tenant, and this often happens with market rate tenants, if their income goes down, they have difficulty paying rent, the Housing Choice Voucher Program can make up that difference. So you don't...
Because that money, that housing voucher is there...
Right. You don't lose the tenant. So you have a little more stability in terms of who you're housing and timely payments. And I think the other thing I would say about that is that the ability for the household to achieve that housing, and remember there are people that are choosing that landlord and that unit, is they're getting access perhaps to a better school, perhaps they're closer to a job that they otherwise couldn't afford to commute to. So there's benefits that are social benefits that have to be put on the scale with that landlord's perhaps resistance to participating in a government program.
Well, I'm trying to understand the situation. It seems like there's a built-in stalemate now in Baltimore County because the county executive Kevin Kamenetz was required to introduce this legislation to the council by a consent decree worked out with the Federal Housing Department. Correct.
Yes, that
and
is
he's
correct.
Required to keep submitting it. And as long as he's county executive, and when you look at a 6-1 vote, it doesn't look like it's anywhere close to passing. So it just seems like it's kind of a dance that is not going to actually benefit limited income people in Baltimore County.
I don't think the requirement is one where Kevin Kamenetz continues to have to submit it. I think the next county executive elected still has the requirement to resubmit. So it's a perhaps a more prolonged dance. I think the other thing to say, and while Baltimore County was a focus of the effort to get the Home Act passed, there's also been the same effort at the state level. A number of jurisdictions in the state do have source of income legislation already in place, and so they thought perhaps Baltimore County might adopt it. But a state-level source of income bill has been fought for over the last decade in Annapolis. It's come very close to passage a couple of years, but it's been a continuing issue. A number of jurisdictions use that, don't seem to have adverse effects from it, and do have some very good outcomes, such as a wider distribution of vouchers so that they're not concentrated in areas where a lot of people, of poor people, are living.
Another landlord has called us, Jonathan from Baltimore City. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to make a comment. I was a former landlord in Baltimore City, and I had tenants that were in these sort of programs. One of the things that I find troubling is that the inspectors, they do come through these type of properties a little bit harder than they would if it wasn't a private landlord. And one of the things that's the most troubling is that they have a tendency, at least MBQ, which is a Section 8 type of program, to mask the tenant's rental history. So you may have tenants who had serious problems in other properties, and they make a serious effort in masking that history. I had a tenant that set my apartment building on fire, and I didn't know that she had did this at two other places. And MBQ kept it a secret because it was part of her mental health history. So, you know, these programs being forced to take it, that's going to fall back more so on the small landlord.
Jonathan, I appreciate your call. I'm surprised at what you say. Patrick Mayer, have you encountered this kind of account?
I would say to the contrary. One of the things that was emphasized as part of the effort to get the Home Act adopted in Baltimore County is what's called the Consider the Person campaign. And it's essentially to look at the issues that make somebody a good tenant or perhaps not a good tenant, like getting references from prior landlords. This is sort of a fundamental landlord responsibility, is to look at the landlord's credit, look at their tenancy history, do the inquiries that make sure that you're dealing with somebody who's going to be a good tenant in your property, and the income is taken care of by the voucher. I'm not aware of the masking, but on the other hand, did Jonathan reach out to those prior landlords and find out what happened?
Well, actually, I found out that the tenant, when she gave me her prior address, she gave an address that was her mother's house. And the program that she was in supported that information. I only found out that she had these problems after I went through the eviction process and I tried to attach to do a wage garnishment, and I found out that she had changed her name a bit just so that you couldn't really find her in the system. And what I discovered is that in the 10 years of operating, this wasn't unique. Most of my Section 8 tenants, most of my MBQ tenants, they all had this sort of thing where they would hide their history, because even though they're in these programs, they still had serious violations of allowing other people to stay in their property, even though they're not on the lease, or they were had others who were selling drugs or did all types of gross damages to their property. So this is not a unique thing. And I have friends who are in the business who refuse to take these program vouchers because they know that Section 8 and these type of programs are not forthcoming with information.
Jonathan, I appreciate your giving us your view of how it works. Thank you for calling Midday. We're going to take another quick break here, and lots more to talk about Port Covington and whether affordable housing should be included there in South Baltimore. You can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about affordable housing, how to make more housing available to people of limited incomes in Baltimore and surrounding counties. I'm speaking with Patrick Mayer, inclusionary housing expert and a leader of the Opportunity Collaborative, a consortium of public and private sector representatives that studies obstacles to sustainable development in the Baltimore region. You can join our conversation. Should Port Covington have to commit to making more than 10% of the 7,500 proposed mostly rental residences that they're talking about? Should more of those be affordable? Do you think the city should be making stronger demands of developers? Do you think the market could meet this on its own? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or email us at midday@wypr.org. The Opportunity Collaborative, it was, what, about 5 years ago that you issued?
2011. It was, the report was issued, though, in 2015, June of 2015. The Regional Plan for Sustainable Development was issued really just last year.
I re-skimmed it this morning and was noticing there were so many suggestions, but especially the idea that affordable housing should be located in areas of opportunity. I think your group found that more than half, like 60% of affordable housing was located in areas of least opportunity, and a big part of that was transportation. Are you seeing any response to that? Is there any we hear so often that people just cannot get to, they have no reliable way of getting to a job from where they live. They can't find an affordable unit they can't find a way to live that would be closer to work, and so they're sort of stranded with either unreliable transportation or they just can't even try to get to work. Is anything changing?
Let me say there's been a small victory that's happened with the involvement of the Baltimore Metropolitan Council and the Housing Committee that's there. There's actually been a special award by HUD of 100 project-based vouchers, going back to the Housing Choice Voucher Program that we were mentioning, which the region is making available to areas of opportunity throughout the region, outside of the city or potentially within the city, if it's an area that scores highly in terms of access to opportunity. So that's a positive step forward. It's a small victory in light of the need that we discussed earlier. But it's partly, I think, a good sign in that the region is working together to make those units available, again, really for families and orienting it to accessing opportunity.
So how could someone who's hearing this conversation and wants to have a crack at one of those units, how should they proceed?
Well, right now the stage is that the Baltimore Metropolitan Council is issuing an RFP for developers that would like to use these vouchers. So it's at the beginning of the process. There's a group that's called the Baltimore Regional Housing Partnership that will be administering the program, allowing people to access those units.
So, and again, how many units are we talking about?
Just 100.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But it's a good start because it really has been a collective effort to work with HUD to get some additional vouchers, which are in very short supply, and to be able to gear them specifically to accessing opportunities. So I'd say that's a positive step forward. Other things that could be done, I think, though, haven't been done. And that's really why we formed a group that really is a successor to the Opportunity Collaborative, which we're calling the Opportunity Coalition. What happened with the Opportunity Collaborative is that good plans, reasonably good plans, were developed for a variety of things that link together things that are important to how families live and really have good, you know, good, enjoyable lives. Transportation, housing, employment, kind of the big trifecta of what people need to be able to live and be successful. The plans that came out of that effort are now in a document that's called the Regional Plan for Sustainable Development. It can be seen at the Opportunity Collaborative's website. What's happened is the plans have been adopted. Relatively little has been done to transform those plans into reality. We formed a group called the Opportunity Coalition, intended to educate people about what's in the plans, develop the campaigns, if you will help people move those things into reality, because they take things, I'll say, like adoption of good, strong, inclusionary housing policies they take action by our elected officials. They're going to take campaigns to convince people of their merits and sustained work over time. This Opportunity Coalition was made up with a number of the people that were involved in the Opportunity Collaborative, particularly the non-governmental institutions. We've got involvement from universities, from some of the big foundations in Baltimore City. But we really need civic engagement, and we need individual citizens to start caring about these things. We believe that putting these policies into effect will really strengthen the Baltimore region, particularly in given the issues that exist in Baltimore City and some of the inner parts of the counties. It's going to be important to address those issues in an equitable manner in order for Baltimore and the region to be healthy over the long run. We think that we've got to get to work on that. The Opportunity Coalition is actually having a meeting where we're encouraging interested citizens, other nonprofits, other organizations to attend. It's on September 13th. At the Impact Hub. I understand you're going to post a link to it on your website. We'd really like people to turn out for that because we need their support.
So that's September 13th, which is a week from this coming Monday at a week from this coming Tuesday will be September 13th at the Impact Hub. Where is that?
I believe it's 500 West North Avenue. I may not have the exact address, but it's
okay. But we will have a link to that on our website. I want to get back to the situation in the city. I don't think I've really asked you what you think ought to be done with Port Covington. There's Yep. supposed to be this memorandum of understanding that the developer Sagamore will try to make sure there are some residences affordable for moderate income families. It's not an obligation.
Yeah, the city has entered into an agreement with Sagamore, really in light of the fact that they don't have a strong inclusionary housing law at the moment, as we discussed earlier. They need to adopt a stronger law, and I believe that it ought to apply to Port Covington. Right now, I think the developer is making a good faith effort to include some affordable units. 10% at relatively high income levels, in my view, is not sufficient in light of the public benefits that are being conferred on Port Covington. And I'll say just one of the things that people don't think about very much. Port Covington really is an old industrial area that Sagamore, I think, smartly bought up and assembled a terrific parcel of land, and one that has, I think, tremendous potential. But they're asking the city to transform it in terms of that rezoning to something that's much, much, much more valuable than what it was when they bought it from the individual owners who had it. The fact that the city is willing to do that, the fact that the city is going to have to increase a whole variety of things like the parks budget, the policing budget, all of that to service, what could be a wonderful development in Baltimore, isn't reflected in terms of the public benefits that are flowing from that development, from Port Covington and from Sagamore at this point. I think the equation is unbalanced at this point. I think it'll be a great win for Sagamore and Under Armour.
Let me make sure I'm following your point. You're saying that that Sagamore, the developer, will get a lot of additional value from decisions that the city is about to make about that parcel of land, and therefore, with that value, the developer owes the city more than the city at this point is getting from the developer.
That's a short way to put it. Yes, I think everybody knows about the TIF.
The tax increment financing, the $550
million. $565
million
goes to the development of the infrastructure of that community. It's money that the city is issuing using bonds. It is a necessary investment, but it's also something that without which that development could not proceed. And so the creation of the benefit for the developer, the ability to hopefully make a great deal of money on that development, requires a huge city investment. And I don't think what's being received by the public is commensurate in value.
I know City Councilman Bill Henry has a proposal to rewrite the inclusionary housing ordinance. I've not read it. I imagine you have. Does it solve the problems that you see with the city's approach?
Not in my view, Sheila. I'm a member of the task force that the City Council has convened to look at the changes to the city's inclusionary housing law. At present, I don't believe what Bill has proposed goes far enough to improve the inclusionary housing law. Right now, he's only proposing that the requirement be applied to developments that are receiving major public subsidies from the city. So I think by denoting that in a TIF as one of the major public subsidies that are listed, he's limiting who the law is going to be subject to, and it'll be developers that are already receiving a great deal of money from the city, money or other public benefits like land at a reduced value. And then the requirement for the affordable units is, an additional cost that will be required to be paid back, or I shouldn't say paid back, but filled by the developer. So it adds, if you will, an additional financial burden to a development that's already receiving a major public subsidy. And I think it focuses too narrowly on who the law will be subject to, or developments which will be subject to the law.
We have just a minute or so left. Let me ask you to step back. When you look at all these moving parts that we've discussed, tax-supported private in investment in affordable housing, the inclusionary ordinances in many places, and the one that's being rewritten in Baltimore, how optimistic are you that people of limited income are going to find soon units that they can afford? How much progress are we making or not making?
You know, I'm not optimistic. Part of what's happening at the same time that we haven't discussed is federal support for housing programs in general has decreased. That's true for job training, things that will help people get job skills as well that would enable them to enter the employment market and support their families. Federal monies really in general for social programs are being edged out by the growth in programs like Social Security and things that are entitlements. So I think the burden falls more heavily on local governments and state governments to fill that gap. And frankly, and in large part, they're not stepping up adequately.
I appreciate your giving us this sobering view of the challenge and perhaps some of the steps that ought to be made to meet it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
Patrick Mayer is Executive Director of the Innovative Housing Institute, a national nonprofit. He's one of the leaders of the Opportunity Collaborative. And a reminder, the Opportunity Collaborative is having a meeting September 13th, a week from Tuesday, at the Impact Hub on North Avenue. We'll post a link on our webpage at WIPR.org. I also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has become a hot topic on the campaign trail. If approved, it will be the largest regional trade accord in history. The pros and cons of the TPP tomorrow on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.